wish I had a cool, catchy phrase to start these out. Or someone else. I could be like, hey, how have you been? And they could be like, yo, how are you? A little back and forth action. But I can't because it's just me. So fortunately for you, we can just jump right into this month's case, right? Which is Judith Barcy. And this is, it's not very graphic, but I do just want to let anyone know who might not want to hear about child abuse, verbally or physically. You might want to skip this, just so you know. But we are going to talk about Judith Eva Barcy, who was born to Joseph and Maria Banco Viravas Barcy. And if I butchered those names, I apologize because I did try. I watched videos with people with the same last names to get the pronunciation. But I don't know if it's correct. So I always like to apologize if I say a name wrong because people get touchy about that. So they were both Hungarian immigrants after they had fled the Soviet occupation. In the late 1970s, Maria was working in a restaurant which was popular with the Hungarian community, and she met Joseph, who was a plumbing contractor. And he actually got her attention in the restaurant by paying for drinks with $100 bills. So I imagine he just ordered like a well vodka and then slapped down a $100 bill. And she thought that was pretty cool. So they got together, they married shortly after, and on June 6th, 1978, Judith came into the world. And friends of Maria said that Maria had almost an obsession with making Judith a star because of Maria's own former aspirations of becoming an actress. Maria's brother, Joseph Weldon, said that when Judith was two, Maria was talking about making her a star, and he was like, don't even bother trying. The odds of that success are 10,000 to 1. But by the time that Judith was five, she was discovered while she was at a San Fernando Valley ice skating rink, and a television crew was already there shooting a commercial, and they noticed her grace and her poise for such a small child, because Maria had essentially been grooming Judith with these old Hollywood notions and practices for years already. A couple of years, because she was only five. So the television crew approaches Judith and her family, and they ask if Judith would be interested in appearing in a Donald Duck orange juice commercial. And this kind of started Judith's mainstream commercial career, because she was in tons and tons of commercials. I think that I read in several sources, 72. A lot of them said more than 70, or they would say 70 to 100. I didn't go through her work history to look at every single one, but I did get an idea of some of the major ones. And I watched a couple of them, and she's so adorable. My favorite personally is the KFC, Kentucky Fried Chicken, with all of the kids and the big boot. I felt like I remembered that, but I think it came out like just a year or two before I was born, but I swear it seemed so familiar. Anyway, it was major brands like that. It was Jif peanut butter, McDonald's, like I said, KFC, Campbell's soup, to name a few. And there's a kind of a notable thing about the Campbell's soup one. If you read about this case, a lot of people say that there were so many takes for the Campbell's soup, it was tomato soup in particular, that she would never eat the soup again because she was like so disgusted by it by the end of shooting, because she had to do so many takes like slurping up this soup. I just thought it was cute. So in 1985, Judith went on to star in her first made-for-TV movie called Do You Remember Love, alongside Andrea Barber. If that sounds familiar, that's because that's Kimmy Gibbler from Full House. And her and Andrea struck up a little brief friendship, and they would pass notes back and forth to each other between their trailers. And then Judith went on to star in a made-for-TV series called Fatal Vision. Fatal Vision is actually based upon the real life crimes of Army Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, who was convicted of murdering his pregnant wife and two daughters. Now, some think that Jeffrey McDonald is innocent, and it's kind of similar to a Darlie Routier situation. So someday we may possibly cover that too. But in the early apt named TV movie. She plays Kimberly, the 3-year-old daughter of Jeffrey. She was a very petite girl, so she was playing roles much younger than her actual age. At the time of her death, she was 10 years old, but she was portraying roles as a 7 or 8 year old. And in fact, she was so small for her age at a time, she was taken to UCLA and given hormone treatments. But her small size worked to her advantage because she could play the roles of much younger children and take better direction than an actor of the same age that they were portraying. Maria's dreams of a successful career for her daughter continued coming true, and by the age of 7, so this was only 2 years later after being discovered at the skating rink, Judith was earning over $100,000, which would roughly be about $260,000 today. So not too bad for a 7-year-old. And her income allowed the family to purchase a home in the Los Angeles West Hills neighborhood. Now, the family had previously struggled financially. They were on welfare for some time while Joseph was unable to work. And Joseph did not want Maria working outside of the home. So while Judith's success was rising, her parents' marriage was actually taking quite a nosedive. Joseph began drinking more, and that led to 3 DUI arrests, and he started acting aggressively toward Maria and Judith. And oftentimes, he would actually be triggered by Judith's success. He was witnessed by friends and neighbors making derogatory comments about his daughter, who he often referred to as little one, but he would say things like, "She's a spoiled damn brat," or he would tell friends of Judith's who knocked on the door to ask if she was home to play. He would say things like, "Oh, that little ass, she's not here." So one of the most notable stories is that neighbors say they saw Judith playing with a new kite, and she was worried that her father was going to break it because I guess he was drunk and belligerent, which was becoming more common. So she was upset and she was crying because she didn't want her new toy to be broken. Joseph takes the kite and breaks it into a bunch of pieces right in front of Judith, and then calls her a spoiled brat who doesn't like to share. All I can do is just make these noises because this is not a visual medium, and I am trying to refrain from cussing on this podcast excessively, so I feel like this episode I'm just going to be going because I can't wrap my mind around a father and that kind of stuff, but moving on. Some people said that he, during this kite breaking event, aggressively pulled her ponytail. And after this happened, in order to make amends with Judith, he bought her this little pink TV for her bedroom. So it seemed like it was kind of a pattern that he would go off on these rages and be emotionally abusive and then sometimes physical, but just buy her gifts to make up for it. It seemed to be kind of a theme. Joseph was previously married to a woman named Clara. She was another Hungarian refugee that he met in France, which is where he first fled. And they had 2 children together while living in France, a son named Barna and a daughter Agnes, who went by Augie. And now in an interview, Augie says that her father threatened to kill them all the time and burn their house down if Clara ever left. So she explains that Joseph grew up in Hungary without his own father in his life, and because of that, he was mercilessly bullied in school. I guess at that time in Hungary, it was very uncommon for you not to have a father, and you were really looked down upon. It was having a whole family unit was very, very important, even more so than America, I've gathered from some reading during this time. And this resulted in no self-esteem, according to Augie, for Joseph, unless he was drinking. That was the only time that he really felt like a person, she had said. So after the family came to the States, they settled in New York, and Joseph's abuse turned toward his son. So Clara eventually left, and she took her children to Arizona. And Joseph followed them and was trying to reconcile and, you know, do the things that men like this do, but Clara was like, we're all set, bud. And so he moved to California. Augie described the last time that she was at her father's home visiting. She could really tell how afraid of Joseph Judith was. And a family friend, Elizabeth Linden, I believe is her name. I tried to make sure that that was correct, but I couldn't find a lot about her. I just happened to find an interview that she was in from a long time ago. She said during this interview that Joseph told her husband about Maria, quote, "I'm going to kill that whore. One of these days, I'm going to kill her." And a friend of Joseph's, Peter, I believe it's Kivlin, recalls Joseph saying that he would kill Maria on many, many occasions. I saw a few things that said it was 500. And I don't know if that was just this guy being like, oh yeah, 500 times, you know, not being very literal. So I don't know, but he made it sound like it was a lot, very frequently. So when Kivlin asks Joseph, if you kill her, what will happen to your little one? Because remember, that's how he referred to Judith a lot of times. And Joseph responded, I gotta kill her too. So, like Pete, buddy, I'm not here to shame anyone, but like, I gotta ask, what were you doing? So if you're telling people or reporters, being cited in these articles that this man has told you more than 500 times that he was going to kill his wife and then that he would have to kill his daughter too. Like, do you think maybe you should have said something to somebody? Because I understand you get mad at someone or you're in a relationship and you're like, ugh, I could just wring his neck. I could strangle him. Ooh, I'm going to kill him when I get home. Ooh, he better hope that he isn't dead because I'm going to kill him if not. Like, we've all said things like that. But if somebody's telling you this 500 times, do you think maybe you should say something? And even if you don't want to say something because this man is saying, oh, that whore, my wife, I'm going to kill her. I'm going to kill her one of these days. Like, okay, that's cause for concern. But let's just take that out of the equation. Once you say, oh, yeah, I got to kill the kid too, like, that's it. That's enough. Somebody needs to be telling someone about this. I don't know. Sorry I went off on a rant about it, but wowzers. So a neighbor, I don't know that his neighbor's name, just it was like a lot of different neighbors that were talking to reporters and things like that after everything went down. So this unnamed neighbor reports that Joseph told them, quote, Judith's just a kid and has got more money in the bank than I'll ever see. It makes me sick. Sometimes I just like to strangle that little brat. Again, what? Another neighbor by the name of Bill, I know I'm probably going to say this incorrectly, Genovese? I don't know. We're going to go with that. He said that Joseph once told him, quote, my wife is such a bitch, I can't take it anymore. Someday, I'm going to kill that bitch. Someday, I'm going to kill them, I'm telling you. If someone says they are telling you, please tell someone else. Like, I'm telling anyone who is listening to this, if someone tells you, someday I'm going to kill them, and them is referring to their family, please tell someone this information. Someone of law enforcement, preferably. It blows my mind. Again, like, you know, we never know what we would do in these situations, and I'm not trying to like blame these people, especially because some of them have been named. I'm just curious. My brain is curious. Now, LAPD Detective Sandra Palmer was quoted saying, how do we protect someone from threats? We really honestly can't. And that is a good point. And again, this was in the 70s and 80s, so sadly, things were a lot different. I mean, even now, things aren't taken so seriously, depending on a number of factors. But even back then, I think it was more easily brushed off as well. Now, according to Maria's brother, Joseph again, Joseph Weldon, while Maria and Judith packed for the Bahamas to film Jaws 4, which was also known as Jaws the Revenge, Joseph came into Judith's room and held a kitchen knife to her throat, telling her that if she and Maria didn't come back after filming, he was going to cut her throat. So Maria tells everyone this upon arrival about how scared she is for herself and for Judith. And Judith's studio teacher said that Maria was expressing her concerns so often that people just began not to believe her. They were basically taking the attitude of, Like, oh, here goes Maria again, just worried about going home to this crazy person. So, because she's saying it more often, that makes you believe that it's not believable. I couldn't understand the mindset with that one, but, you know, that's the attitude that everybody had on set, is she talked about it so much that it couldn't have been true, and she was just talking about a crazy guy. Wild. So Joseph, I'm getting tongue-tied with all the Josephs. Joseph tracked them down at Brother Joseph's house, and he threatened Judith again by calling and reminding her of what he had said before they left for filming. Now, Joseph Weldon said that Judith was so frantic that she was crying in a bedroom with his own daughter, and Maria was, quote, going out of her mind. But she ended up returning home to Joseph the next day with Judith. There is some speculation that Maria didn't want to leave because they would have had to hide, which means they would have had to remove Judith from filming, and they would have lost that source of income because Maria, again, didn't work outside of the home. Augie claims that she had discussions with Maria about taking Judith and leaving to be safe, but Maria said that they had worked too hard for their home, and if anyone was going to leave, it would be Joseph. Now, Maria did secretly rent an apartment, and during the day, she would escape Joseph's drunken rages there with Judith, but they always went home at night and slept at the West Hills address. Linda Williams, a neighbor, again, of the Barcys, told news media that Judith wasn't even allowed to go up the street unless Joseph first gave permission because he was afraid that she would run away. Now, according to a National Enquirer, I've always had trouble saying that. I'm sorry. National Enquirer article in August 1988, which, like, take all of that with a grain of salt for any news source because we're talking about NE here. But a quote-unquote insider reported that Judith told an agent just days before her death, quote, "My daddy says he's going to kill us and burn the house down. I'm so afraid, and so is mommy. I have nightmares that I'm being killed just like in Fatal Vision." It breaks my heart. Like, it breaks my heart to look back and read this stuff, knowing that all of these people were listening to this and nobody was doing anything. Now, it's reported within this article that Maria had rented the apartment in May of 1988, and she had planned to take Judith and move the weekend of July 30th and 31st with the help of Tracy Gold and her family. Tracy Gold was Judith's Growing Pains co-star, if you remember that little show, Growing Pains. Her and her family were going to help. And then according to the Barcy's neighbor, Eunice Daly, Maria told her in mid-July that Joseph had grown suspicious and followed Maria to the apartment, demanding to know why she was taking boxes there. Maria told him that she was giving away items to some friends who lived there, but then she told Eunice that she didn't think Joseph believed her, and that now every night when she heard him drinking and prowling the house, she dreaded every moment. According to this article, the reason that Maria insisted on waiting to leave was because of a $12,000 IRS refund check of Judith's that she didn't want Joseph to get his hands on when it arrived and be able to cash it. Now, Tracy Gold apparently told Maria, like, who cares about that money? Like, you can earn more. And she begged Maria to move out, but Maria allegedly refused. In December of 1986, Maria did file a report against Joseph. She claimed that he had choked her and, you know, hit her physically, punched her, things like that. But because she didn't show signs of physical abuse, nothing really came of it, and she decided eventually not to press charges against him. Joseph continued on with his threats of killing his family, burning their house down if they ever tried to leave him. It's actually reported that he received notice that a relative of Maria's in Hungary had passed away, but he hid the information so that Maria and Judith didn't leave the country, because I'm sure if they did, they wouldn't have come back. Within that article, it was stated that Judith told her best friend, quote, "One day my daddy got wild and started throwing pots and pans at me in the kitchen." Oh, this is hard for me to read. "He hit me in the face and I got a bloody nose. I just want to get away from my father. We're always scared." So although Maria was a full-time homemaker because of Joseph's opposition of her working outside the home, he complained about her inability to keep the home tidy, like, a lot. And he would bring his friends over, actually, reportedly, to show them the mess that she left around the house, which I think is weird. But I read in other sources that that might have been intentional because Joseph was such a neat freak. And so Maria was like, I'm just going to leave mounds of clothes and piles of trash and just like make this house really dirty and unkempt, because that might be a way to drive Joseph out. Unfortunately, it did not work. Now, struggling under Joseph's abuse, Judith began exhibiting some signs of distress. She had started plucking out her eyebrows and her eyelashes, as well as her cat's whiskers. Judith's agent at this time, Ruth Hansen, referred her to a child psychologist after Judith had a breakdown during a singing audition for All Dogs Go to Heaven. After one session, the psychologist reported Judith as an abused child to Children's Services. And in June 1988, the Department of Children's Services case was closed because Maria assured the caseworker she had plans to leave Joseph and take her and Judith to live full-time at the apartment that she had been renting. This particular caseworker was assigned 67 cases at that time, which was about 27 more than what would have been considered a full workload. According to Ruth Hansen, though, Maria said the department wasn't doing anything to assist her and that she would have to, quote, handle it herself. Robert, I think it's Chaffee, I'm not sure. Anyway, at that time, he was the director of the department, and he was quoted as saying, "You had a man who was bound and determined to kill his family, and that's what he did," when he was defending the department's actions and stating that the whole caseload had nothing to do with the outcome. Okay. He went on to say, quote, "Unless you had a police officer on the premises with the mother 24 hours a day, it would have happened. I don't see how this agency could have stopped it." And Chaffee also stated that Judith was not interviewed by the social worker because Maria didn't want her to be. A lot of people blame Maria heavily for what happened. And, you know, clearly it's easy to see why they do. But something also to consider is that in an interview, Augie said Maria also grew up in a household with an abusive father. So until we have experienced something like that, or, you know, fully understand the emotional trauma and how that shapes a person, I think it's easy for us to say what we would and should do. That is not to say I'm defending nor condemning Maria. I'm just saying a lot of people are like, she was money hungry. She didn't want to leave because of the money, the possessions, all of that, which I think probably did have a part of it. I mean, my personal opinion doesn't really matter. I think that was part of it because she didn't work and she was probably worried how she would take care of herself and her daughter if she didn't have that income. But, you know, I think an abused person's mind operates a lot differently than someone's mind who hasn't been abused. So just something to consider. Now, Maria's niece said she spoke with her aunt around Christmas time, and Maria had explained that Joseph was having an affair with another woman who was well-to-do financially. So Maria explains that she was going to contact an attorney to discuss filing for divorce. Maria was like really encouraged by the situation because she's thinking like, this is my way out. Like, this is great. Yes, please shack up with this hussy. Like, we're great. She told her niece that it was the best thing that had happened to her. On July 25th, 1988, Judith had missed an appointment at Hanna-Barbera Productions, and Ruth Hansen spoke with Joseph that day, and he told her that a big car had come to take Maria and Judith to San Diego. On the evening of July 26th, Ruth once again spoke with Joseph, and he told her that he had planned to move out, but he wanted to stay long enough to, quote, say goodbye to his little girl. Neighbors recall the last time that they saw Judith was on Monday the 25th, and she was outside riding her bicycle around. I think I read in a couple places she may have been playing with a friend in a sprinkler, but everybody says they saw her riding her bicycle, and that was Monday the 25th. On Wednesday, July 28th, around 8:30 a.m., Eunice Daly heard an explosion and saw smoke coming from the Barcy home. What first responders discovered was the explosion, most likely a gunshot, because the home contained three people who were now deceased. Judith was found in her bed with a gunshot wound to her head. Maria was found in the hallway with a gunshot wound to her head. And Joseph was found in the garage with a .32 caliber pistol that he had used to murder his wife and child still in his hand, and a gas can about 4 feet from his body. Evidently, this was the same can that he had used to douse his family's body with gasoline before taking his own life after setting the house on fire. It is believed that Joseph killed Judith and Maria Monday or Tuesday and remained in the house with their bodies until setting the fire. So that would have been, you know, about 2 days, 1 or 2 days that he just hung around in the house with their bodies. He went into the garage and then put the gun to his own head. It was difficult for officials to determine an exact time of death because the bodies were so badly burned, they were initially beyond recognition. On August 9th, 1988, Judith and Maria were buried at Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Hollywood Hills, California, in the Sheltering Hills section. And until 2004, their graves remained unmarked until Nancy Kelly, who was a previous on-set tutor for Judith's last year of school, she started a fundraiser and she raised enough money to purchase proper headstones engraved with these like really sweet messages. Judith's headstone reads, "In memory of the lovely Judith Eva Barcy, our concrete angel." Yep, yep, yep. This was a really well-known line as her character, Ducky, in The Land Before Time. I think anyone listening to this podcast knows exactly who I'm talking about, and they can hear that yep, yep, yep in their mind. That was Judith. It was one of her biggest roles and one she's most known for. And it's also reported that the reason that Ducky says yep, yep, yep is because that was Judith's reaction when she was offered the role. I don't know if that's true. There's no way to confirm that, but I like to believe so because I think that is the most adorable thing ever. And Concrete Angel is actually a nod to a 2001 Martina McBride song about an abused child that has always been like super haunting to me. If you've ever heard that song, it's kind of hard to listen to, and I would turn the radio if I heard it on. But now, knowing that that is what Judith's headstone reads, like if it ever comes on the radio, I'll probably have some type of emotional reaction because, wow. Maria's headstone reads, "Maria Agnes Barcy, wind beneath J.E.B.'s wings, yep, yep, yep." Obviously, J.E.B. is Judith Eva Barcy. In 2020, a show called Murder House Flip did renovations to the Barcy home. A family who had purchased the home and lived there for nearly 20 years reported feeling like this dark presence and cold spots in the hallway. The garage door would always open and close on its own. And then in Judith's bedroom, the new occupant's bed was placed in the same position as Judith's had been. And she had experienced terrible nightmares, like the entire time that she lived there. So these renovators come in and they brightened up the hallway and they added French doors into the girl's bedroom that had been Judith's just to let in some more light, as well as they decorated with some amethyst crystals. So kind of an even sadder note is I had stumbled upon this website called Concrete Angel for Judith Eva Barcy, and it was being run by a friend of Nancy Kelly, Celia is all I could find her name. I noticed that the day that I was visiting this site, the same day there was a message posted, and the site owner explains that she had not been updating in about 6 months, and that she's had some things going on, but she also explained that Nancy had passed away on July 16th, 2021. So that kind of bummed me out. Judith's half-brother, Barna Barcy, is said to have been plagued by alcohol, much like his father, and he ended his own life by throwing himself off of a bridge in Scottsdale, Arizona in 1995. Now, for some reason, a picture of Jonathan Brandis has been attached to Barna's name online. I have no idea why. Like, I literally could not figure out why there would be a connection. I don't think there is. I can't find anything. I didn't dig too deep into it. But, like, why is the kid from Ladybugs showing up with his name? It's weird. I like to try to end somewhat on a positive note if possible, and there really isn't any joy to be found in this story at all. But a bittersweet ending is to say that Augie went on to become an author, and she wrote a book called Triumph Over Cancer, A Natural Approach. She was a life coach and an internet radio talk show host, and she passed away on December 2nd, 2008, but she is said to have lived for fun. Positive affirmations, she had a wonderful view of the future. So I hope that Judith and Maria and Barna and Augie and Nancy are all resting peacefully, is what I hope, because it really bummed me out that like everybody has passed away, but hopefully they are somewhere better doing what they love. So that was the really depressing and tragic story of Judith Farsi. But, you know, I think the reason that we have to continue to tell these stories is because there's a lot of lessons to be learned here. So I'm just, again, going to say, if someone tells you that they are going to harm their family, let alone say, I'm gonna murder my wife and I'll probably have to murder my kid too, like, please tell somebody. Please do something. Make an effort. At least tell the authorities, and then we can bash on them later for not doing their job. But wow, I just researching this, I was like, there's so many opportunities here that this could have been prevented. Like, what were we doing? And there's a little bit more that you can read about as far as Children's Services. If you go in and you read statements from them and you read about the review, because they did go up under review to the board, they didn't really have the resources at the time, I guess, to like have somebody monitor, and there was issues with removing Judith from the home, things like that. So, you know, you can always look into that. It's not to say that nobody was doing anything. I feel like more people could have tried to do something. But that's me off of my soapbox now. So again, if you want to check out some pictures of Judith because she's so freaking cute, you can always go to Instagram, A Pine for True Crime. If you want to send me any messages about anything, your own stories, whatever, you can hit that at apinepodcast@gmail.com. And if you ever want to show any appreciation, a really quick, easy way is Apple Podcast reviews. They're always really helpful. I need to look in to confirm. I don't think you have to be an Apple user to leave those reviews, but if you are an Apple user, which my analytics say most of you are, then throw me a review. That is a real quick, painless way for you to say, hey, thanks for babbling on and saying I'm a whole bunch in our ears.